Now, because this is being recorded, I need to say that the title of this is I Thought There Would Be Cake, which is an excellent title. Catherine Welby-Roberts is here. I know that you've all come to see her. Some of you will have heard her at Greenbelt a couple of years ago. She struggled with her mental health for many years, lives with three conditions she describes as life-altering: depression, anxiety, and chronic fatigue. Maybe you heard her, it was 2 years ago, wasn't it, that you were here? Yeah. You may have heard her talk about it in the media. You might be a regular reader of her blog, but now she's gone a step further and written this rather fabulous book called I Thought There Would Be Cake, and we're very delighted that she's come back to Greenbelt to talk about it. But you've been here a few hours, so how's Greenbelt for you?
So far it's been great. I've had a bit of wine.
Oh, good.
And a lot of sugar.
Oh, even better.
So I went out, I got taken out, I got paid for on a date with two lovely young ladies, and they bought me candy floss. They didn't buy me the wine. So it's been great.
Excellent. So you're sugared up.
Yep.
And ready to go, which is quite appropriate since this is called I Thought There Would Be Cake. So tell us a bit about why it's called that, first of all.
Everyone asks me this question and I'm getting really bored of it. No, I'm not. So, no, I will answer.
Feeling
it,
good about this.
Yeah,
so
yeah, it's going to go so well. Yeah, so basically, I don't know if anyone else had this when you were kids and you looked at the adults and you thought, oh, that looks like so much better. They're in control. They can go to bed when they like, eat what they like. Basically, be free from parental control. And then I became an adult and I was like, I want my mummy to tell me what to do again, please. So, yeah, I thought life would be a bit easier than it's turned out to be.
Yeah. So given your struggles with anxiety, and part of that being that you're only too aware of what others think of you, you're kind of putting yourself out there by writing a book, aren't you? How does that feel? Why do it? Another question that she's probably really bored of. No? Oh, good.
No, that one's got quite a straightforward answer, really. It's basically because I'm a bit of a fool. And I think, you know, I quite like writing how I'm feeling, because if you write how you're feeling, then, you know how you're feeling. Well, that's how I operate. If I'm thinking it, I don't know what I feel because it's all in my head. If I write it down, I know what I feel. So I do that. And then I'm like, anyone want to read? And then they read it. And I'm like, why did you read it? That's personal. So, yeah, reckless fool.
Yeah, okay. I mentioned the three conditions that you sort of feel that... that you have, and that are life-altering, as you call them, depression, anxiety, chronic fatigue syndrome. So just tell us a little bit, just to start us off, about when and how they became apparent.
So I was diagnosed with depression at 19. Do you know that just came right off? I'm so used to it. It's great. At 19, and I think it had been probably settling in for a couple of years. And I didn't, like a lot of people feel very... low when they're diagnosed. I just didn't really feel at all, which again is quite common, I think, for a lot of other people. And I thought that it was a bit weird. And I was relying on living in my head a lot to get through kind of standard day-to-day interactions. So I went to the doctor and I explained, and he did, how many people have done that questionnaire at the doctor's?
Yes, I feel like this. Yes, yes, yes.
No, I am not suicidal yet. That's always how I go. Yes, yes, yes. No. So I did that and he was like, yes, you're depressed. So I did nothing in response to that. And it kind of built over the years, and anxiety became an increasingly common thing, and I was getting more and more tired. So I then had a breakdown and then got diagnosed with chronic fatigue, and here we are.
And these three have a significant impact on what you can and can't do. So tell us a bit about that, what that impact is on a day-to-day basis.
Essentially, I have to check every thought when I remember, which isn't very often, for whether it's truth or not. Think about how I respond to interactions. Is it rational and logical, or is it just my anxious brain having a little fit? Also, you know, I avoid certain situations such as crowded spaces.
Mm. Talking in front of a lot of people on a stage. Yeah.
Yeah, that loud noises, bright lights, stuff out of my control. So basically, if I was to pinpoint the perfect trigger to cause me an anxiety attack, it would be, you know, this. So it might happen.
And we've got the sugar.
Oh, yeah, that makes it so much better.
So we probably should mention the kind of Episcopal elephant in the room. Do you know, I might be excommunicated calling him that. Was that okay to call? Anyway, moving on. Presumably the fact that your dad is the Archbishop of Canterbury has given you a platform to raise mental health issues more generally and get people talking about them. But I wonder if it's also the attention that you could do without.
Sorry.
Was that a spider?
Yeah.
Okay. That's not any trigger for any... No.
I don't like them.
Okay, fine.
But I think I handled that very well.
Good. You did it brilliantly. But I mean, the attention that you get from being put in that position, I imagine you could do without sometimes.
Yeah, I think usually the times I could do without it the most are the times that I kind of go and try and get it the most, which I guess is the way that mental health problems can often work. Or that's how it's worked out for me, in that, you know, the times when I'm at my illest, such as when I first started tweeting after he got announced, you know, that's when really I need to step back and recognise that it's not so healthy for me. And I do recognise that when I'm quite well, so I don't do it. And then I get ill again and I'm like, oh, hello, everybody. So, yeah, it's... But it's just, you know, the way it is, I suppose.
But has it actually been helpful to you, do you think, being put in that position and doing the speaking out? Does that help?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you certainly kind of find a whole new community of people who have a very similar experience to you, and that certainly is... helpful. And also because of the conditions I have, and because actually working full time is not a possibility for me, I just can't actually physically handle it. So it's kind of, it feels like I'm contributing something productive, even if it's not kind of working like many people do.
So who do you hope will read your book? Who's it for, do you think?
I guess people who are like me. you know, it's I never really set out to write a book that was very me focused. We were talking about a book and I wanted to kind of think about the issues that I've written about in terms of how common they are and how many people are facing questions of self-worth and self-doubt. And explore what it would mean to embrace ourselves as we are. And that's what I set out to do. But I'm not really an expert in anything other than myself. So in trying to explain what I was trying to do, I found that I'd written basically this whole thing about me, but it wasn't really meant to be like that. So I think that the reason I started it all was because I am tired of not really feeling remotely comfortable in my own skin, and I was aware that so many other people were too, and I wanted to go on a journey together. And so the way it's worked out, I think what I'm hoping is that people will read it and sort of take me out of it and use it as a way of thinking about some of the issues I'm talking about and kind of go through that journey with me, and so that we can do it with this community of people who are all dealing with the same kind of stuff.
And it actually struck me reading it that these are all very human issues. This isn't just the kind of thing that affects people who would identify or have been labelled as having mental health struggles. Actually, it's about our emotional health, and an awful lot of it could apply to any of us to one degree or another.
Yeah, and I think, you know, certainly the issues that I've addressed have been made bigger and stronger and have had a bigger impact on me because of my mental health problems, in that I have a brain that is programmed to hear everything and see everything around me in a more negative light than often it's meant, or someone could even imagine it could be taken.
Well, I mean, actually, that leads me on to the first thing I wanted to ask you about in the book, about taking some something that most of us would regard as being very positive, and the way you kind of hear that and experience that, like when someone gives you a compliment, which is for most of us a good thing, but it doesn't feel like that necessarily to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would depend, really. I mean, I had an argument with my husband the other day, which is quite a common occurrence. And, you know, basically he was like, well, I was saying, you know, he should, I have my hair cut, and he didn't say I looked beautiful. So I said, you know, you could have said it. He said, well, if I say it now, you won't believe it. And I was like, well, you should have said it before. And I think it's that before I had to tell you to tell me I was beautiful. So I think it's that thing, isn't it, of kind of, I don't really believe it so much from people I know and love, because I know that they love me. And so, you know, of course they're going to say nice things to me because they want to make me happy. And so what they say can't really be trusted, which is incredibly unfair. And I'm very sorry.
But it sort of goes deeper than that, doesn't it? And what you mentioned about one of your reasons for doing this being about recognizing that we have worth, that we have kind of inherent worth, and when someone gives you a compliment, there's a sense of not believing that because you don't believe the being of inherent worth bit. Yeah,
I mean, I think essentially it's a very uncomfortable thing being complimented when you don't believe what someone is saying is true of yourself, and they're saying it and you know that they mean it sincerely, but you're kind of, half of you is thinking, well, what does that say about you if you think that of me, because I know better. And that does put you in a kind of vicious cycle, because you're a bit like, well, I want people to tell me I'm lovable, but when you tell me, I'm not going to believe you because I actually know better. And you put them in a very difficult situation as well, because they sincerely mean what they're saying, but you're not taking it like that. And it just spirals.
And in a faith context, of course, you talk about particularly sort of Psalm 139 in your book, and about us being created intentionally, and all that entails. So there's a bit about sort of knowing all the jargon and knowing it all in a headway, but actually sort of being able to take that on board, which frankly I think is something, you know, many of us struggle with, the kind of head, heart, or all of that, but it has a kind of different colour with you, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've reached a point now where I can read those words and I can know they're true in a way that is more than just basic knowledge, but it hasn't yet. You know, it doesn't change the way I feel about myself. Mm. It's just something that I can kind of combat some of those thoughts with by just going, well, I know that this is the truth, and I'm just going to force myself to accept it as truth for the time being. But it is incredibly difficult, you know, to think of somebody loving you to that degree that they will quite literally do anything for you, and that they don't see you as flawed. You know, they see you as who you are above and beyond anything else that you see. And I just don't know how you take that on board fully. And that is part of the journey that I'll continue going on.
Mm. And do you find that there's an expectation from other people within the church, within your faith, who kind of think that bit's easy to kind of say, but this is what the Bible says, this is what we believe, what, you know, that's just it. That's the way it is.
Yeah, you get that a lot. And I'm sure most people who have suffered anything in church will have experienced that to a degree. And I think that the thing with that is those people, in my experience, are either one of two things. Either they're just not allowing themselves to explore who they really are, which I think does quite often happen, or they've just had a really nice life. And, you know, that's great. And I'm really happy for you if that is the case. But it isn't the case for everybody. And it certainly hasn't, you know, I've had a very nice life. It's just, you know, my brain kind of hates me. So I just have to fight that. And you know, the Bible says a lot. And I do wonder how much people truly, you know, how much it's, people saying that to you is actually them trying to convince themselves of it. And, you know, they're saying, but, you know, you're loved, and God says this, and God says this, and God says this, and God says this. And you're like, well, yeah, I know he says it, but do you really feel that? I mean, can you take it beyond knowledge into feeling? And if you can, how did you do it? Mm. And what was it? Because, you know, I've met with God. I've had experiences that were really powerful in a spirit way, but they kind of stand out as lone moments rather than as a, you know, they don't give me a constant charge. They tell me that God is real and they keep my faith alive because I've experienced that, but they don't take me from day to day. And I just wonder, I mean, I wonder genuinely, how do those people believe it so convincingly of themselves? And I wonder sometimes as well, because I can say those things to other people. You know, I can talk to other people and use that language. And I wonder how often they're basically me just hiding behind what they've heard and what they've been taught, and using that, because actually I genuinely mean well when I say it as well. And I think it can help. It just depends on the context in which it's said, I think. Mm.
Something else you talk about in the book is about misinterpreting the times when people are, I mean, in a way, it goes back to being people giving you compliments. But when people are being wholly positive and encouraging, actually, you sort of see something else in it. I mean, I'm thinking of the big birthday party story, for example.
Yeah.
What do you talk about that?
Yeah. So this was a birthday party. It was a big birthday, a huge party happening of a very good friend of mine. And, you know, as I've said, for me, crowded spaces, bright lights, loud noise, absolute hell. And so she texts me and she said, hey, I was thinking about it and I'm thinking maybe you don't want to come to the party. Maybe you'd rather it if her and her husband met up with me and my husband and we all went out for dinner. Which showed several things. Firstly, it showed that she saw me for who I was, flaws and all, which is amazing. She didn't reject me for that. In fact, she embraced me with it and offered me an alternative that would make me feel safe. She didn't just say, I know it could be too much for you, so if you don't want to come, really, it's not a problem. She offered me something else, something better, something more personal, where I'd actually get time to chat with her and spend some proper time with her. And so obviously, with all of that in mind, I went, well, she hates me. She doesn't,
obviously.
I mean, that's just blindingly obvious, right? Like, she doesn't want me at her party because I'm a liability and I'm going to have a meltdown, so she's just trying to hide me away. So, yeah, I think it is really difficult because how do you communicate in love with somebody who, no matter how loving you are, how generous you are and how much you've thought about them, is going to go, well, you hate me every time. It is very difficult.
So how do you combat something like that when you're you?
I think I've learned that I need to talk about it with that person and explain why I'm reacting that way. Like, why is it that I'm kind of going, that's a sign of real distrust and lack of love. And I need to step back from it as well and kind of try and put the emotions down for a few minutes, or days, and like just explore what it is that it actually means. So in that case, I didn't handle it the best. You know, I kind of replied like, oh, okay. And she came back to me and she was like, what? And I was like, well, you know, like, no, it sounds lovely. And she was like, you feel rejected? And I was like, well, yeah. So we had this whole conversation. We talked it through and we came to a point where I was like, okay, I see that you're trying to love me well, and actually that's really nice. And within a couple of days, I was absolutely fine. I was like, oh my word, I'm so glad I've got such nice friends.
But is that something you've learned over the years, how to deal with that kind of situation amongst others?
Yeah, and I think mostly I have to give it time to be able to kind of recognise the gesture for what it is. And I think I also have to accept that it's just never going to be a case where I'm going to see it as love straight off, because my brain doesn't work that way. My brain goes, everyone hates you. Of course everyone hates you. Everyone's going to prove they hate you and everyone's going to abandon you. And therefore, when someone does something, even if it doesn't confirm it, it feels like it confirms it. So I take it as confirmation. And then I have to break it down and go, oh, hold on a second. I did it again.
Hmm. And you're very, very open in your book. Searingly honest, I would say, at times, about those things in you, the things that happen to us all that feel like that we end up feeling shameful about, that we end up feeling hugely guilty about, the things that we aren't proud of, that can't be described as good and positive. And you talk about those. And for most of us, we suffer a bit with them, we struggle with them, we park them, we blank them, we do all of those kind of things, whatever, but move on. But tell me a bit about this idea of replay. You'll probably do that with this interview, presumably.
I'm already doing it.
Oh, Lord. but I mean, but tell us a bit about what that means and what that does in you.
It's essentially thinking about what you've said or what you haven't said or how you've said something. And because I read everything negatively, I assume everyone else will too. So I'm always nervous that what I've said will be taken the wrong way. And if it's something that had been said to me that someone would take, that I would take the wrong way, and I've said it to someone else, then I just feel terrible. Or if, you know, I get very fired up in conversations about certain things. You know, I think everyone's got their hobby horses, and mine are quite varied and, you know, pop up regularly. And so, you know, I get really fired up, and I get quite, what I think is quite sharp in conversation, and I say things which really I wish I hadn't said. And so instead of just going, oh, I'm really sorry, I've crossed a line, or instead of just checking in that someone's okay with what I've said or how I've said it, I, you know, retreat and replay the conversation, and it gets worse and worse and worse in my head. And it used to be that I'd do it and I'd never deal with it. And it got to a point, I had one that came off the back of an interview I'd done. And so I did this interview, and then a year later, it'd been this awful thing where every day for a year, every time I thought about that interview, which had been quite a big one, I just felt humiliated and horrific and so ashamed. And a year later, I was at an event talking to members of the media about how to treat people in interviews with mental health problems. And I was asked to do it because of this interview. And so I'm sitting there ready to detail this interview and why it was so painful for me. And the guy who interviewed me walks in to join the audience. And I'm sitting there going, and on this stage with me on this panel, there was all these like news presenters and people who are all fancy and important. And there's me sitting there with my hands like this, kind of tucked between my legs going, and like the whole panel for like an hour, I was breathing out every 30 seconds. I was like, I've got to go. No, I'm not going to go. I've got to, no, I'm not. And I did the thing and I could see his face. He was like, you know, the only person I could see in the room, and I could see his face and just the horror as he realized what had happened. And as a result of that, we sat down and we chatted afterwards. And I was suddenly like, oh, you know what I should do when I come away from something where I feel awful? I should talk to the person about, you know, how I feel. Because I haven't felt shame about that interview since that conversation, because I was able to say, this is why it was so difficult for me. And he was able to say, I'm sorry. And so I just have to kind of, I've recognized now that replay is toxic, and it takes absolute control of my thinking, and it destabilizes me and it spirals me, and it's the only thing I can think about. So I go and talk to someone, usually my husband. And then once I've kind of clarified what it was that has got me unsettled, I'll try and talk to the person if I can that happened with. And that seems to, if it doesn't kill it completely, it'll certainly make it livable with.
And take some of the sort of venom and toxicity out of it. Now, since you were here last, you've become a mum.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely thing.
Yeah.
But how has that affected your mental health?
Well, it's funny, actually. It's only in the last couple of weeks that I've realised the answer to that question. When he was born, I kind of went into shock. And I think a lot of new mums get this. But they gave him to me. And I just kept on saying, I said it like 10 times or something, maybe more, but it's a baby. And they were like, my mum was there and Mike, my husband, were there, and, you know, the midwives who I knew quite well. And they were like, what were you expecting? And I was like, I don't know, but I wasn't expecting this. So I kind of went into shock, and it took me quite a long time to kind of get over that. And it took me about 4 weeks to realize that he was there permanently. And every time I looked at him in that time, you know, I'd look at him and I'd be like, he's so cute, but can someone take him away now, please? And then, you know, for the first 4 months, I really struggled with anxiety, you know, everything. Am I feeding him right? Is he getting enough? Is he putting enough weight? Like, all of this kind of, you know, fairly standard stuff.
And I mean, comparing yourself, it's a classic when any of us become mums, that we spend our entire time comparing ourselves to other people.
Yeah, and, you know, desperately longing to be with other mums, but then when you see them with their babies the same age as yours and their babies are doing things, like, my son refused to smile at anyone other than me and my husband for a while, and I was like, he does smile. He really does smile. And everyone else's babies is like... So like there's just so much in there, and I think I just thought, you know, I'm used to living with depression, I'm used to being depressed, it's been my life since I was a teenager, you know, it's been it's been over half my life, so I'm very accustomed to it. So I hadn't realized that I was getting iller and iller, and it's only in the last few weeks where actually at the moment I'm really very unwell. Which isn't funny, but it kind of is at the same time, because I think I'm the highest functioning I've ever been when I'm ill, but I'm as ill as I've been for quite a few years. And I think that that's been creeping up on me, but because I've been so happy and my life is going so well, and I've basically, you know, someone described it as something earlier, Matt over there, I can't remember what he described it as. It was great. I can't remember though. So, you know, that's a great story. So, but, you know, like, I've hit this perfect point in my life where I've got kind of the dream, and I'm actually really quite unwell. And I think that that's been building since he was born. And I think it's, you know, kind of changed everything, and that's great, but it's also desperately destabilizing.
Mm. No, absolutely. And how do you look at your issues as he grows up? What would you like him to kind of understand
about mine?
Well, yes, but also in the sort of wider context of people who have these kind of issues.
I'd like to be starting to talk to him about how he's feeling very young, make it normal to think about how are you feeling, because I think that's one of the things that we're so used to in society is not actually thinking about how we're feeling, because that can become overwhelming, and I don't want him to get overwhelmed, but I want him to be trained so that, you know, he can just be aware. And I think that's the point I've got to now, where I'm increasingly able to be aware of where my line is and where stable is, where I am and where unstable is. And so I can measure myself and I can go and get the support I need at any given point, but I don't let it dominate everything. You know, just because I'm ill, I'm not gonna, you know, unless I get very, very sick, I'm not gonna stop doing everything. I'm just gonna stop the things that are gonna make me worse. And, you know, I just want to hopefully try and train him to think about both himself and those around him in terms of what's helpful, what's unhelpful, and how can we keep ourselves healthy in the same way that, you know, you don't spend ages thinking about how your physical state is. You know, you don't spend ages going, I must eat very healthily, or, you know, this is going to go wrong and I must do, you know, you go, oh, I need to eat this, I need to do this. And we know the things that you have to do to keep yourself relatively physically stable. And I'd like to just train him to get to a point where he can do that with his mental health. It's just about checking in, registering where he is, and doing what he needs to do to deal with that. And I'd like to learn that myself.
You can learn together.
Yeah.
There you go. So yours, as you've talked about, are long-term conditions. I'm wondering whether you pray for complete healing from them. How does that fit in? I'm sure other people have. How do you feel about that?
I pray for healing for myself, and my husband does, and there are a few other people, very select few other people, who I will allow to pray for my healing.
Right.
And that has been something I've had to learn over the years of, you know, very well-meaning, very kind, very loving people who really want to see me get better. And so they want to pray for me to get better. But actually, that's putting an awful lot of pressure on me. and I don't need that pressure. I don't want to have to explain to them, if God doesn't heal me, why he hasn't healed me. That's not my job, it's not my role, and I'm not going to do it anymore. And I don't want to explain to them that it's not my lack of faith that hasn't healed me either. Thanks. So I'm very protective of that particular thing, because I've learned over the years, having been really damaged emotionally and spiritually by people who really do intend good things, doing it wrong and doing it in a harmful, damaging and destructive way. And So I believe God does heal. I believe he can heal, and I believe he will heal, and I believe he has healed. You know, I don't think that just simply because I still live with these conditions, God's been sitting on his ass doing nothing. I think he's been working in my life. He's changed my life. He's created in me a strength and a resilience that I didn't have before. He has stood by me, and he has been the only constant in the darkest points in my life. And I would love it if he would do the one thing that I'm desperate for him to do, but I'm also incredibly grateful for what he has done. And I think healing is so much better, bigger than physical cure. You know, healing is about salvation. It's about God being in your life with you, journeying and bringing you closer into relationship with him. And I continue to pray for the physical cure, but if it doesn't happen, then I will trust that every time I pray and ask God to heal me, he does something significant that will change me.
Do you think we hear enough in our churches and as people of faith, we talk enough about the times when prayer does go unanswered, particularly for these kind of conditions?
No. I think people really want... It's very tiring journeying with people who are in the same state long term. And anyone who's a carer or lives with someone with a long-term chronic condition, particularly certain types of conditions, but all conditions, you know, it can get very tiring continually praying. So if you're not in that position, then you know it's very easy to give up, I think. And also, you know, we want to hear the happy stories because it gives us hope. We want to hear the stories where God comes and does something miraculous.
And that's not wrong to hear those.
No, it's great. We need hope and we need to see that God does move miraculously. But we also need to experience the fact that when God doesn't answer our prayers in the way we'd hope, he answers our prayers. And we need to teach people that, because the number of people that I have come across who say, I don't understand what God's doing. You know, he promises me this and this and this, but he hasn't done anything and I'm just so angry with him. And it makes me really sad, because I think anger with God is understandable. It's human and he welcomes that. As we can tell by the Psalms, you know, he's not afraid of us venting on him. But at the same time, God has offered us so much. He's promised us so much. And if all we see in our relationship with him and in conversation with him is what he hasn't done for us, rather than the extraordinary things that he has done for us, and if we don't... if we don't cling on to that, then actually we're failing ourselves, but we're also failing the rest of the church. If we don't demonstrate that in the darkest of times, in the most painful of times, God does miraculous, extraordinary things. I mean, just simply the fact that I'm alive is a miracle, because I got to a point where the only thing that saved me was the fact that God gave me hope. And if that's not God saving, then what is? And so... why isn't that a story worth telling? Why isn't that a story? You know, God is still here. He hasn't walked away, unlike many other people who have needed to for their own sanity, and I understand that. But I don't think it's right. He stayed. You didn't. Not you. Sorry. Sorry, that was very rude. I'll point. in other directions. But, you know, so don't tell me that, you know, don't stand there and only tell me hopeful stories. Tell me stories that offer me hope for now, that don't just offer me hope for a better future, but offer me hope for tomorrow and tonight and the next hour.
As you continue to live in the darkness.
Yeah.
Anyone hear those stories in church? Do people stand up and talk about those? Oh, no hands.
Oh, one hand.
One hand.
Hello. Yay.
Great. That does feel really, really important to hear those as well as the others, yeah?
And I think it's just about understanding. You know, a lot of people, especially in the line of church that I'm in, and I mean, I have been in some phenomenal churches that have done some amazing things and have really embraced me. But it's very difficult, and I understand the human instinct towards those victory stories. But this idea of victory, and this is what I spoke about last time I was here, this idea of victory, you know, is something that we can all embrace for us now. You know, we have victory in Christ. The Bible tells us so. It's already done, and everything from here on out is victory. Therefore, we have victory in suffering. Christ is with us. We have relationship with God in a way that was unforeseeable before Jesus came. Well, not unforeseeable, it was, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm very tired and high on sugar, and that's beginning to come down, so excuse the garble. But, you know, like, we have this relationship, and he's done a lot for us, and I think we just have to acknowledge that right now, whenever we're in pain, that, you know, God's still there. And a lot of the time, if I was sitting in church and I heard somebody who was on the same journey as me just a few years down the line, who hadn't been healed, who was still living with it, but spoke with hope and spoke of what God had done in their lives, my faith would have been transformed years ago. But as it was, it took a fight where God fought for me in a way that no one else ever did, and he showed me himself. But actually, as a church, we have a responsibility to teach and to show God, and that's what God does, so that's what we should be doing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, you've done a lot of work on helping churches to understand more about mental health issues and how we can better support people within our church families. So tell us a bit about that. You know, it may be something that people here would really like to do better.
How we can better support people. I think, does anyone here know who I mean when I say Rick Warren?
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess quite a lot of you then will have heard the story a few years ago of what happened with his son, who committed suicide. And Rick, since then, has done a lot of stuff, a lot of campaigning around this. And a few years ago, I don't know how many years ago, quite a few years ago, 3, 4, he came to the leadership conference at HTB, and he talked about it. And what they wanted to do off the back of it. And loads of people off the back of that were really excited and going, we want to do mental health. And I think that that is the fundamental error. I got so many people coming saying, we want to do a mental health Sunday. And if you want to do mental health, then don't start on Sunday. Because in my experience, some of those churches that I'd been to, and if someone had stood up, if the church leaders had stood up at the front of the church and said, we're going to talk about mental health this week, I'd have got up and walked out, because they were so bad at it that it wouldn't have been of any help, and all it would have shown was their own ignorance. And that was incredibly hurtful for me, because I was like, actually, and you know, I was saying, don't do that. Sure, you can do that months down the line, but first, talk to the people in your congregation who have mental health problems and know what they're talking about. Secondly, ask them what they need. And over time, build up something where you can stand with authority and teach people about mental health. But until you've got that authority, until you've had that journey, until you've been with people, seen what it does to them on a day-to-day basis, understood that for some people it's a permanent state of being, and understood the degree of suffering and the lack of commitment they can often give, and you've chased them when they've not shown up at church, but not in a pressured way. You've just said, hey, how's it going? I noticed you weren't there. Like, you know, that kind of stuff. Do the journey, be human, be relational, be family, be church. I mean, that's what church is about, right? It's about saying, hi, how are you? But we forget that. I mean, it's also about Jesus. I mean,
there is that.
We don't, but Jesus was relational, you know, like, and that is fundamentally what he was. He never healed anybody without saying, what can I do for you? And we don't do that. We go in with the prayers. We go in from the front telling people that we're going to do mental health. But we forget to say, what can we do for you? And that's where we need to start. Mm. So if you want to get better at this, and many of you are probably already doing it, you start by saying, what can we do for you? How can we serve you? How can we make you welcome?
You've talked a lot about your husband and your mom and the people that are really close to you, who are obviously a really crucial part of the journey that you've been on and you are on. There'll be people here who are trying to do that and walk alongside somebody they love very dearly who is struggling. And I just wonder if you have anything that you can say to them to encourage them in that walk alongside.
Yeah, I think it's been a really interesting year this year, because I've learned a lot about how little I used to communicate with my parents, and how little I used to tell them of how I was doing, and how little I let them support me. But the fact is, I've come back to them, my mom in particular, as much as everyone wants me to tell them that my dad is amazing, he is. But seriously, my mom... you know, I've learned that I need them, but it took time and it took relationship and it took patience on their part. And I think that that's the biggest thing. You know, actually, if someone's pushing you away, don't let them. I mean, step back, allow them to see that you're giving them space to process and to understand, but keep an eye and be there, because actually my mum, after Mike, is the first person I go to when I'm having a bad day. And that is a complete turnaround from what it was just 4 years ago, when, you know, I applied to go to a Bible school in America and told my parents afterwards that I'd done it. And my dad was like, well, you know, there are a few here and... maybe I could have helped you with that one. You know, and that was in 2012. So, you know, in the last 5 years, we've completely transformed our relationship, but that's through their patience, and they're not pushing me, but they're being present and available and constant, and letting me know that that's where they were, but not harassing me. And for me, that was the thing that has changed everything. For Mike, you know, he lives with me. He's just, I mean, you know, I love him. He's very nice. I don't quite know. You know, I still, every day I'm like, do you love me? Are you going to leave me? He's like, yes, no. And I'm like, okay. But I don't understand it. It genuinely baffles me. I mean, seriously, the guy has to live with me every day. And I can get very annoying. So, yeah, I don't know how he does it. I'm no use for people actually living with somebody, because I marvel at him. And I think you're heroes. I think, you know, people living with the condition, it's really, really difficult and it's really challenging and it's really hard to explain. But the people who live with you are just as heroic, because they're offering you something that no one else can. And I don't know how Mike does it, but I love him for it. And for many other reasons as well.
So early on in your book, you talk about what you hope the result of writing the book will be, which is partly about by charting the things you find so hard that cause you such difficulties that you might get closer to accepting who you are. So you've finished the book, it's out. You can buy it next door, by the way, and Catherine will be signing at 8 o'clock this evening in the, what's it called? Bookshop.
That
next
place.
Door, that way. But so that's kind of part of what you were about when you were writing it. So here we are at this point in that journey. Has it done any of those things?
Yeah, I know. Like, who else wants a really quick fix? Because I really want a quick fix. I want to... I had hoped and dreamed and fantasized about writing this book and coming to the end, you know, just joyfully in love with myself and content and at home in my own skin. And, you know, I've never been a very realistic person and, you know, that was proven through writing this book. I struggle with myself a lot still. I find it very difficult to be me. But the thing that I have learned through this book is that that's okay. And it's actually normal. And I feel more comfortable. I feel safer and I feel more at home in my own skin than I ever have before. And I feel like I've moved a few steps forwards and that's more than I had before. So I see it as a success. And also I don't so much want a quick fix now. I'm quite happy to journey it because I've learned a lot through starting to really explore it in more depth and detail, and I kind of am intrigued to see where it ends up.
Mm. We're going to do some questions. I'm sure you have some, but just before we do that, I'm sure you'd like to thank Catherine for what she shared.
Thank you.
Now, because it's quite cramped in here. I think it would be quite dangerous for someone to march around with a microphone and trample on you all, despite our crowd surfing idea, which I still think is good. So if you can, if you want to ask a question, if you sort of holler it out and I'll repeat it so everyone can hear it. So does anyone have anything they'd like to ask Catherine? What this lady's saying is that 6 years ago suffered a lot of very traumatic events, which... going through all those made her realise that she was depressed and had anxiety attacks and terrible time, signed off work. Minister at church, very supportive. Tell me if I'm not getting this right. Very supportive, but had some problems with some of the older members of the church who would say, "You don't know what stress is. It's just about getting out of work." Da da da, which was incredibly hurtful. Is that fair? Yeah. So she's just asking Catherine about things that you should and shouldn't say, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really difficult one because there's this whole thing about saying things in love. And actually with somebody like that, some comments like that, there's not much loving that you can say when you're in a really desperate state. And so I find that you either just say nothing and feel awful, or you say something really unpleasant and feel awful. And so I think it's taken me quite a while where now I'll have a conversation with someone about it. If they're willing to have that conversation and, you know, say, you know, kind of explore and just very calmly. I mean, I'm so used to it now and I get it less and less because now I go around talking about mental health. No one's going to say anything bad to me because I might use it or something like that. But, you know, try and kind of ask people why they think that. Like, why do you think that only older people know what stress is? And do you understand that, you know, there is a lot more in the mind that can do harm than, you know, work stress. Sometimes it's something bigger than that. And I'd have that conversation about mental health, but some people aren't willing to have that conversation. At that point, you just recognize a lost cause and you know it's actually not you, it's them. And I mean, it's a cliche, but it's 100% true. You know, if someone will not accept that there might be things in your life that they don't understand, that has nothing to do with you. And I've taken a long time to get to a point where I can accept that. And it'll bother me what they've said. And I tell it to my husband and he goes, ah, 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 and I feel so much better because I know they're unreasonable.
Okay, so this lady's talking about replay and saying that something she can relate to, but what she tends to replay is things from a long way back that she can't actually now address and do anything about. So just wondering if there's any thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the ones I talk about in the book is one from, I mean, now it'd be about 8 years ago, which, you know, I've lost all contact with that particular girl because of that event, and I have no way of dealing with it. And I think I've taken to, with the old ones that really bothered me, like, there was one I had with my brother from when we were, like, I don't know, very small children. And with him, so obviously with him, I talked about it, but then I spoke to my counsellor about the other ones, the old ones that I can't do anything about. And, you know, it's just a matter of kind of learning to put them down. And, I mean, obviously, they still bring up feelings of shame because I haven't been able to process them in the way that I've learned to process those situations. But at the same time, I'm learning to kind of, when they flit into my head and I feel ashamed, to say, actually, I am repentant in some situations, or I've spoken to people about what I said and it wasn't that idiotic, or, you know, whatever the situation is, accepting, like, forgiving myself or allowing myself off the hook. And it is a daily practice sometimes with some of them. You know, it's something I still have to do all the time, and it isn't easy, and it doesn't take away that weight. And sadly, there isn't, for some of these things, there just isn't an answer other than kind of talking to someone. So owning it to somebody, if it's something that you've kept very quiet, which it was the case for me, and that will break some of the pain from it, or it did for me.
And sort of the power of it, presumably.
It's no longer this dirty secret, which, you know, when I told my counsellor, one of them, she was like, oh, because I'd spent like, I mean, she didn't dismiss it as irrelevant. You know, she's actually a very good counsellor. That would be awful. Oh, that's nothing. You're an idiot. Get over it. Very, very carefully considered. No, but, you know, she was like, oh, because it'd been like 3 weeks of me going, oh, no, I can't. And she was like, oh, okay, we can deal with this. But actually just speaking it out helps for me. And I mean, there isn't an answer, really. It's just about owning it to somebody that you trust completely, and then letting yourself gradually, or if you can, like magic, zap it away. But sorry, it's not much use.
This lady down here. Okay, this lady say, oh, hang on, let me just. Okay, has a problem with church. Who else does? No. And sort of wonders to what extent the sort of expectation. Tell me if I'm getting this right. The sort of expectation to be part of a large disparate group of people. Conforming in a repetitive way, how it can that be detrimental in itself to mental health? Over to you.
That's a really easy question to answer. I think essentially, yes, it can be detrimental. Church is meant to be family, it's meant to be a safe space, and it's meant to be home. But church is made up of fundamentally flawed people, and that is part of the beauty of it. And I think, you know, we're meant to meet together. I think the Bible tells us that. It doesn't say we have to do it in this set format that has become church, but it is very important, I'd say, to meet regularly with people to challenge your faith and to talk about your faith and to worship God. But what form that takes, I think, is actually up to us. And we need to be accountable to that, because there's going to come a time when we're going to need to be accountable for it. But goodness knows, you know, I mean, what would God say to half of the ways that we do church? I think there are times when I've been in a service where I honestly think Jesus showed up, he'd be thrown out. You know, so, you know, I think conformity, sorry, I just saw someone I know. Sorry, I've been looking for him all day. Sorry. Sugar, it's not my fault. So I think there isn't an answer to what church should be. And I think it's, you know, it is our journey and we need to be in Christian community. But I've got loads of friends who are in great Christian community and never step foot into a church. But they are challenged when, you know, they're challenged to meet with God, to talk to God. They talk to each other. Their faith is encouraged and grown and flourishing through that community, through that church. And that's what church is. And so I don't think that we need to conform to the kind of stereotype church. I think we're free to do what we need.
Right, we have only a few more minutes left and I'm really sorry. I'd love to get to all your questions. There was somebody who waved at me, the lady with the dark hair there. Yes, you. Yes, ponytail. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just wanted to give you a vision from a few years up the road, really. So I have three adopted children. As a consequence, we've always talked about feelings and about relationships and about birth mother, birth dad and that kind of stuff. What's happened recently is that I managed to fulfil my own prophecy, so I have managed to move my marriage between me and my husband after 15 years. And I had 2 days of non-stop crying, and I said to my children that I feel like I'm a failure because I didn't manage to stay married, and I must be the worst mum ever, and I'm sorry for crying, it's the heavens on my brain, and blah blah blah. And my children said, no, actually, Mummy, you're the joint best woman in the world because we've got you and we've got our tummy mummy, and one made us and the other one's bringing us up. And things do go wrong. And in even basic things like Inside Out, Inside Out really helps with talking about emotions. And just last weekend at church, I said, my church, we're allowed to swear, actually.
Woohoo! Right. Did anyone not hear that? Okay, listen, very briefly. Fantastic story. Thank you so much. This lady's saying that she has three adopted children. They've been very open about all kinds of things. Her marriage broke up, and obviously that had a huge effect on her, but also on her children, and they talked about it a lot. And what she's saying is to kind of give hope, really, to Catherine, but also to others, that actually going through those things and being open with your children has given them a kind of emotional intelligence that makes them able to walk alongside, even when they're really little, to walk alongside other people. And that's a very wonderful thing. Do you want to say anything about that?
That's lovely. Thank you.
Really lovely. Thank you.
Can I do one more question?
All right, one more question, and I saw you first. Sorry, that's really awful, but sorry. There you are. Okay, how would you say, to what extent is coming to terms with the fact that you have a mental illness in itself part of the healing, a healing in itself?
Yeah.
A healing in itself.
I think it's a nice way of saying it, and I think certainly to a degree, but I'd say the biggest thing it's done is enable me to understand how to manage it. So in terms of it takes out, coming to terms with it is taking out a lot of the complexity of living with it, because I'm no longer fighting the diagnosis or fearing it or running away from it. I'm now just saying, okay, this is something I'm living with and I'm dealing with it. So I guess I have probably been better because I've owned it, not because it's made me less depressed or less anxious, but because it's taken out some of the complexity of living with it. Does that make sense?
I think we have to stop there. I'm really sorry. I know there were other questions. I think we could go on talking for some time. What do you want to say?
Just to say, I'm going to go and do the books, but I'm not going to hang around to chat now. And I feel really guilty every time I do this, but otherwise my brain will explode. So I just thought I'd give fair warning and say thank you very much for coming.
That's fine. Thank you, Catherine.